This is Tuesday, April 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Milman in Washington. Coming up, tension between the United States and North Korea has led to increased anxiety worldwide.
I do think that there is a tremendous amount of risk on the Korean Peninsula, and I think that rhetoric both in Washington and Pyongyang have made that worse.
That is the person who advised President Obama about nuclear proliferation. We'll talk with him. Also ahead, President Trump is nearing the 100-day mark of his administration. You'll hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone, and you'll hear about a story of how a robot is helping to change the ecosystem in the Caribbean. All on today's International Edition. North Korea marked the 85th anniversary of the founding of its military today with a massive fire drill in the eastern port city of Wonsan, that according to South Korea's defense ministry. Some observers expected the nuclear-armed country to honor the anniversary with a sixth nuclear test or a missile launch, though neither of those had occurred by evening. The celebration came on the same day as a U.S. nuclear-powered submarine, the USS Michigan, arrived in South Korea, and the navies of those two countries joined Japan in conducting military exercises in the waters west of the Korean Peninsula. Joining us on International Edition is John Wolfsthal. From 2014 to 2017, he served as special assistant to U.S. President Barack Obama as senior director for arms control and nonproliferation at the National Security Council. He was the most senior White House official setting and implementing U.S. government policy on all aspects of arms control. He is now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. John, thanks for being with us. This increased tension between Pyongyang and Washington has raised the anxiety level among many people. In your opinion, is that anxiety justified?
Well, I do think that there is a tremendous amount of risk on the Korean Peninsula, and I think that rhetoric both in Washington and Pyongyang have made that worse. I think people who are just turning back into the show need to remember that there have been tensions on the Korean Peninsula for well over 50 years, and it goes through cycles of tension and then relaxation. But this is a cycle unlike something we've seen for many years, and there is a great risk that it could get out of control and lead to open conflict.
Well, everybody's asking the reason why has it reached this level? The Trump administration has ratcheted up the level of brinksmanship that has been the role of the North Korean leadership. What kind of effect might that be having?
Well, we have to be cautious because we don't really have very great insights into North Korean thinking. But there's no doubt that the change in America's tone and our approach to the Korean nuclear problem has really put a lot of our allies in the region on edge and has put China on edge in a way that we've not seen before. There are some who believe that this brinksmanship might actually put pressure on North Korea to come back to the negotiating table. I think more likely result is that this will undermine North Korea's sense that it is secure, that the United States is ever going to accept them as a legitimate state and lead them to cling to their nuclear programs more tightly, and perhaps even lead them to try and out-Trump Trump by taking action to put the United States back on its heels. So traditionally, America has played the calming role, has tried not to let tensions get out of control, but clearly under President Trump, as in so many areas, we're going to be trying something new, and the challenge is whether or not we can keep a lid on things.
Well, what is the reality as you see it as to whether or not Kim Jong-un could carry out some of these threats that he's making?
Well, North Korea has, over the past 15 to 20 years, developed a small arsenal of nuclear weapons. They've been able to miniaturize them to the point where they can likely put them on short or maybe even intermediate range missiles that can reach all of South Korea and Japan. What they have not been able to do is develop a long range nuclear missile that can put a nuclear payload on the United States, something that they have said they've wanted to do for many years, and something that they likely believe will deter the United States from either attacking the North or from protecting our allies in a crisis. But we also have to keep in mind that in addition to its nuclear and missile capabilities, North Korea has a massive conventional army. It has thousands of pieces of artillery that we saw in action during the live fire episode that are within range of Seoul, a city of 25 million people in which 100,000 Americans live. So this is a very tense situation. There are a tremendous concentration of military, both conventional and non-conventional capabilities in the region. And I would argue that the United States has a strong incentive to try to calm the situation as opposed to try and create or exacerbate a crisis.
Have you seen any hints so far from anyone in the Trump administration that that is the way they might be going?
It has been interesting to see the evolution of Donald Trump's rhetoric over the past several weeks. His meeting with President Xi Jinping in Florida appears to have convinced him to let the Chinese have some time to work the North Korean problem. China has offered and tried in the past to calm U.S. concerns and to convince the United States to be more patient with North Korea. But that's in large part because China doesn't want to deal with the potential risks that a conflict in Korea might have for it. There's the potential that you might have up to several million refugees flee from North Korea into China, and there would be tremendous economic and security disruption should there be a conflict on the peninsula. So China has basically decided it can live with a nuclear North Korea as long as it doesn't lead to a conflict. So I think that the Trump administration has been willing to be a bit more patient, but at the same time, both misstatements and deliberate statements related to the movement of military capabilities to the region, a statement or a series of statements that all options, including military, are on the table, even though they're not our first choice, which everybody knows is always the case, but don't necessarily help keep a dangerous situation from getting out of control, have been made. And so I think that he's been restrained a little bit, but I think it's still likely that we're going to see uncontrolled or uncoordinated statements coming out of the Trump administration.
Well, as you know, Trump has said that the plan that you guys came up with in the Obama administration just didn't work. How do you answer
right.
that?
Well, we ourselves acknowledge that strategic patience did not have the result we wanted on the timeline we wanted. Everybody agrees that the best situation is a denuclearized Korean peninsula. The Obama administration tried a combination of pressure, relying on China to use its leverage, and the promise of a negotiated settlement, including potentially even a peace treaty and ending the armistice, to bring North Korea back to the table. It's true that that didn't work. But I'd also point out that the Bush administration before us tried a combination of both regime change, which failed, and direct negotiations and a freeze, which also failed. So the reality is that a series of administrations, Republican and Democratic, have tried to stop North Korea's nuclear program. Under the Clinton administration in the 1990s, that program was effectively frozen in a deal that was blown up by the Bush administration in 2002. I think once that happened, it was always going to be a long shot to get North Korea to come back to a non-nuclear status. And I think the Trump administration, if it believes it has a better approach than the one the President Obama team and that we came up with, then he needs to lay it out. The challenge is, in my view, right now, we don't have a single North Korea nuclear policy. We have senior administration officials, including Secretary Tillerson, who has said that before any negotiations take place, North Korea must fully disarm its nuclear and missile programs. He has also said several days later that we would negotiate with North Korea in order to achieve that outcome. President Trump himself has also said that we're prepared to use military force, but we don't want to, that we're prepared to negotiate, but that negotiations aren't viable and have never worked. So I've been watching North Korea policy for almost 30 years. I can't tell you what the Trump administration's nuclear policy is towards North Korea, so I don't know how we can expect North Korea or China to know precisely what our policy is.
John Wolfstall served as special assistant to U.S. President Barack Obama, senior director for arms control and nonproliferation at the National Security Council. He's now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. John, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Ira. Thanks so much for having me.
Among the top stories in the world, instead of an expected show of military force, North Korea marked the 85th anniversary of the founding of its military today with a massive fire drill. President Trump vowed again today to build a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico to block illegal immigration. Turkey carried out airstrikes early Tuesday against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq and northeastern Syria. A daughter of President Trump defends her father's position toward women, saying in Germany that the media's criticism of the president's past attitudes toward women has been perpetuated. Anti-government activists in Venezuela continue a fourth week of street demonstrations to press leftist President Nicolas Maduro for new national elections. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump marks his first 100 days in office this coming Saturday amid intense debate as to whether he's delivered on many of his campaign promises. The 100-day measure of success has been applied to presidents since Franklin Roosevelt took office at the height of the Great Depression in 1933 and enacted a series of measures to deal with the crisis. The 100-day mark is also a time for opposition Democrats to assess their approach to the new president. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is here with us in our Washington studio. Jim, before we get going on this, why is 100 days so important? What made it so important? Was it FDR? Why is it important?
I think it began with the Franklin Roosevelt administration. He came into office in 1933. The effects of the Great Depression were sweeping the country and parts of the world at that point. And Roosevelt had been elected basically on a platform that he would represent hope and turning around what was a dismal economic situation in the United States. And he went about launching incredible government-inspired programs in a very short period of time, almost a frenzy of activity in his first 100 days. So we take that as the template for a very active president. And every new president since then has been sort of measured on how did that person do in their first 100 days. That's where this comes from.
Well, we'll take that as a given because it is a given and also because you say it's a given. But how do you rate Mr. Trump's first 100 days so far?
Well, Mr. Trump himself, I think, rates it pretty well. They say they've gotten a pretty good start on a lot of the campaign pledges he made. On trade, for example, on appointing a Supreme Court justice who's a conservative to the high court, and on signing a number of executive orders that rolled back, say, regulations from the Obama administration period. But look, the critics have a lot of ammo here, too, which is what have you gotten through Congress at this point? Nothing, really. And the big gambit was a health care replacement law to replace Obamacare. That fell apart. Now, they will try again, we think, on that, but it's because of Republican divisions right now, Ira, to some extent that this president is handicapped. But he's also gotten in his own way, I think, at times, with a lot of distractions, often through Twitter, that have taken his eyes off the ball. And sometimes it looks like they want to do everything at once. He's talking about health care. He's talking about tax reform, infrastructure, without actually being very forthcoming on the details, and it's the details that get you bills through Congress.
Andrew Palchesti joins Jim in studio with me. How are people reacting on social media to all of this, if they are at all?
Oh, they are indeed. Over the first 100 days, we're a little short of that mark, but over the first close to 100 days of the administration, what we've seen on social media are these moments that kind of bubble up. And as you just mentioned, reading the headlines, we saw one today where Ivanka Trump was jeered at a women's conference in Berlin when she said that her father was a champion for families, and then later blamed the media for the depiction of her father as anti-woman. A lot of people taking aim at that video clip going around social media. But what we've seen so far is that these moments kind of come and go, whether it's Ivanka or Kellyanne Conway, one of the president's senior advisors, or Sean Spicer, the press secretary. These moments come where they have a misstep or a gaffe, and they get made fun of on Saturday Night Live or the late night talk shows, but they kind of fade away. What I've seen consistently on social media is that while the moments may not live on, the underlying issues do. So even though Ivanka was booed, that might be forgotten in a week or two. The fact that her father has a checkered past with women's issues is something that's going to remain. And those are the issues that really have been driven over social media through the first 100 days. And the flip side of that is that you have Trump supporters who are championing those same issues, whether it's trade or defense or the other things the administration has tried to work towards. You see that as the flip side. They're citing the great progress that's been made over the 100 days. And those are themes that I think will continue past this first 100 days.
Jim Malone, there has been a threat of a government shutdown at the end of the week. coincidentally with the 100 days. It seemed to be tied to Democrats' refusal to vote for funding for the president's proposal for a wall separating the U.S. and Mexico. Where does all that now stand?
Well, it looks like the president has hinted he's backing off on the demand that any new budget agreement at least put a down payment on the construction of the wall. I want to make a joke about being caught between a rock and a hard place here, the hard place being the border wall he wants to build. He has spent most of his first 3 months trying to cater to his political base. That has paid off in polling that shows, for example, in one recent survey, 96% of those people who voted for Trump think it was the right thing to do. They're sticking with him. The problem for the president is his poll ratings in terms of approval are stuck at around 40%. That's a record low for a new president, going back to when they first started doing this kind of polling in 1945 about new presidents. So he's definitely got a weakness there. And I think the Democrats sense this a bit. And he's also been a catalyst for the Democrats to kind of get their act together a bit and have a more unified message moving ahead.
You know, the whole aura surrounding President Trump is that he just wants to be liked, that he wants to win, and that basically, pardon the pun, trumps everything else about him. Is that going into the thinking of people as well, maybe Democrats? I don't know if that's a fair question or not.
Well, it's about style, too, and we have a president who's kind of acting like he was as a CEO of his business. Not big on details, delegating a fair bit those details to underlings, but then we've seen a changing cast of characters in the White House who are in, you know, a favorable position or not. Andrew mentioned Kellyanne Conway. Guess what? She's kind of disappeared from public view for the past several weeks.
Saw her today.
It's kind of like a Broadway play tryout. People have gone on there, gotten their shot, and some of them, if they're not cutting it, they kind of disappear into the bowels of the West Wing.
It's been a boon for social media, hasn't it, Andrew?
There have been so far, just under 100 days, only 2 days where President Trump has not tweeted. So definitely a boon for Twitter as his medium of choice. One thing I want to note, I think this is fascinating. There's a lot of analysis in the first 100 days about his tweets and what he's said and the issues that he's focused on. This is the most retweeted and liked tweet that President Trump has sent out in the first 100 days from January 22nd. And he said, "Peaceful protests are a hallmark of our democracy. Even if I don't always agree, I recognize the rights of people to express their views." That got nearly 90,000 retweets, 350,000 likes. So to the point that we're talking about with this cutting both ways with Democrats and Republicans, I think a lot of Democrats jumped on this and are trying to hold his feet to the fire about some of these issues, including this tweet that he made. The flip side of that is the White House is putting out a website now on the first 100 days, even though President Trump says he thinks that milestone is meaningless. They're putting out a big flashy website where they're going to highlight all of his accomplishments, give people a lot of stuff to talk about on social media.
Andrew Palaszewski, Jim Malone, thank you both. As always, this is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
We continue with International Edition from the Voice of America. In many parts of the world, invasive species contribute to destruction of local ecosystems already threatened by climate change. One of the most pervasive is the lionfish, a voracious predator from Asia that is depleting native coral reef fish in the Caribbean. Now, a new underwater robot is showing off a way that technology can help on the front line fight against invasive species. We get more from VOA's George Pudich.
A voracious predator itself, this exotic venomous beauty is prized both by chefs and aquarium enthusiasts. The fast-breeding lionfish started showing up in the Caribbean in the 1990s. Biochemist and entrepreneur Erica Ebel says it has quickly become a big problem in Bermuda. She spoke to VOA via Skype.
They replicate at a ridiculous rate. So one lionfish can lay 30 to 40,000 eggs every 3 to 4 days.
It has had no natural enemies in the world it invaded until now. A remotely controlled underwater robot recently tested in Bermuda is hunting the hunter, showing off an innovative way to stop the lionfish's killing spree among smaller fish that clean corals in the Caribbean. It was designed by robots in service of the environment, under the motto, you have to eat them to beat them. With two extended arms serving as electrodes, the robot named Guardian, remotely controlled from surface, stuns the lionfish with a quick jolt of electricity before sucking it into its chamber. Next stop, the kitchen.
We need to figure out how to catch the fish, how to bring the fish into the ecosystem of supermarkets and dining rooms around the world. And by doing that, we have a fighting chance to solve this horrible problem.
At the robot testing event, visitors could taste the lionfish prepared in different ways. Executive chef Rob Ruiz, who also spoke via Skype, says lionfish is also interesting from another point of view.
These robots in service of the environment can show that they have a significant cog here within marine protection, within preservation of species, being an effective tool to restore the equilibrium in a particular ecosystem, in a particular ocean, at a particular time.
Builders of the Guardian admit their robot won't make a big dent in this massive problem, but say a more affordable machine could help local fishermen keep lionfish on the menu and provide them with steady income. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
That's going to wrap up our program today. Find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our thanks to Director Patrice Martin, our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vice President Mike Pence visited Indonesia in mid-April as part of a tour of allies of the United States in the East Asia and Pacific region. During a joint press conference with Indonesia's President Joko Widodo, Vice President Pence said that his visit is an indication of the high value the United States places on the two countries' strategic partnership. As the second and third largest democracies in the world, our two countries share many common values, including freedom, the rule of law, human rights, and religious diversity, said Vice President Pence. The United States is proud to partner with Indonesia to promote and protect these values, the birthright of all people. The United States is one of Indonesia's oldest and most engaged defense partners, said Vice President Pence, and we are firmly committed to continuing this collaboration. The strong relationship between our two countries will help us successfully confront the various security threats that we now face, including one of the greatest challenges we both must contend with, the rise and spread of terrorism. At the same time, said Vice President Pence, the United States will uphold the fundamental freedoms of navigation and overflight in the South China Sea and throughout the Asia-Pacific. Will ensure the unimpeded flow of lawful commerce and promote peaceful diplomatic dialogue to address issues of regional and global concern. But that does not mean that we cannot improve on our relationships, said Vice President Pence, noting that the United States seeks trade relationships that are both free and fair. This means creating a level playing field to ensure that American businesses can fully participate in the Indonesia market, a privilege that Indonesia exporters that do business in the United States have enjoyed for many years. What we are looking for is a win-win relationship. I have the privilege of reaffirming the United States strategic partnership with Indonesia and declaring our commitment to strengthen our bonds of friendship, commerce, and security, said Vice President Pence. Through our continued partnership, the United States and Indonesia will continue to maintain a peaceful, stable, and prosperous Southeast Asia for the benefit of both of our nations and for the benefit of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.